Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Neil Barnard. Dr. Neil Barnard is a clinical researcher, a best-selling author, and one of America's leading advocates for health, nutrition, and higher standards in medical research. He's an adjunct associate professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C., and he serves as president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, whose membership includes 150,000 healthcare professionals and concerned citizens. Dr. Barnard is the author of more than 50 published research papers on nutrition and its impact on human health. He's written more than 15 books, including Power Foods for the Brain, The 21-Day Weight Loss Kickstart, and Dr. Barnard's Program for Reversing Diabetes. He's been a frequent guest on Dr. Oz, Ellen, and many other talk shows, and a leader in the medical community and with the public. So now, Dr. Barnard, my dad and I feel honored and grateful that we have this time with you. And for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Neil, for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for including me, and congratulations on the wonderful work that you've been doing.
Well, thank you. And, you know, earlier this year, I saw Drew Brees, the Super Bowl-winning quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, surprise Ellen DeGeneres on her television show on her birthday with a $50,000 donation to her charity of choice. And Ellen chose, as you know, your organization, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. I applauded when she did so, and I know why. And I know why last year more than 3 million people visited PCRM's website to read the latest breaking medical news. Under your leadership, Neil, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine is playing a central role in changing the national dialogue about what constitutes good nutrition and is placing plant-strong diets at the forefront of preventive medicine. I want to thank you, Neil, right at the beginning for the really important work you and PCRM have been doing for so very long.
Well, thank you, John. It's certainly been a team effort. There's a lot more left to do, but I'm glad that we're on the same side working together.
I am too. I know that working with the insurance company Geico, you conducted several clinical trials testing the effects of plant strong diets in the workplace. Your results, which were published in 2010 and 2013, showed significant reductions in body weight, blood sugar, and absenteeism. Can you tell us about your work with Geico?
Yes. This really followed on to some other studies that we had done. Back in 2003, NIH funded us to do a big diabetes study because our earlier research had seemed to indicate that if you go on a low-fat vegan diet, meaning a diet with no animal products in it, keeping oils low, that diabetes would improve, and it does. It improves dramatically, and people lose weight, and their blood pressure comes down, and blood cholesterol comes down. So on the heels of that, I got to talking with the head of health services at Geico's national headquarters, which happens to be just a couple of blocks from my office. And she was explaining to me that they have 2,500 people in that one building alone, let alone all the other Geico plants around the U.S. And the idea was if they went on a healthier diet, it would be a good thing for them from the standpoint of improving their health, but also a good thing financially because every time an employer looks at their healthcare costs, it just seems like they're higher than they were before. So we started a study. The first one, we began a number of years ago at two sites, one here in the Washington, D.C. area and the other in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And at both facilities, we weighed employees. We checked their blood sugar if they had diabetes. We checked their cholesterol and their blood pressure. But at only one of the sites, the one here, they got a vegan program. And it was really simple. All it meant was that once a week, the employees could come to a room where they would learn about plant-based diets and get some help with adopting them, and there was a cooking class, and they could taste the food and so forth. Really, really simple, very efficient. And the second thing was that they provided vegan food in the cafeteria. So they might have the bacon and eggs for breakfast, but they also had the oatmeal bar with cinnamon and raisins and sliced strawberries. And they might have the cheeseburger, but they also had the portobello sandwich and veggie burger and whatnot. And as time went on, exactly what you'd think would happen happened. As people lost weight, their cholesterol improved, everything got better. Their diabetes got better. So then that led to a 10-city test, also at Geico, where five cities got no program and the other five got the vegan program. And the very same results occurred. So then the five cities that didn't get the program all wanted it, and so they got it too. So bottom line, it was lots of fun, and it really showed not just that a plant-based diet is good, but that you can do it at work. You could do it right in any kind of big setting. And so for me, the reason I really wanted to do this was to show if you want to reach people, if they're children, they're in school, and that's the place to reach them. If they're adults, they're at work, and that's the place to reach them. So why not make these kinds of interventions that are easy to plug in and allow people to get excited and make some diet changes? So that's what we did with Geico, and I'm happy to say that since that time, right after we did that, our power company, which is called Pepco, Potomac Electric Power Company, instituted the same program, and it was a big success, and then a number of other businesses have done exactly the same. So I'm hoping that many more will.
Well, that's really fabulous, and I am also hoping and knowing that many more will, because it's profitable to do so, as well as healthy and making sense in terms of respecting their employees.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and we do hear from lots of folks who are doing it. And by the way, if anybody listening to this broadcast says, "Hey, I want in on that," I work at an auto plant or I work at a manufacturing plant or whatever it is. We have around the U.S. and in quite a number of other countries instructors who can teach this. They're called Food for Life instructors, and you just hook up with one in your area, whatever state you might be in, or many other countries, as I mentioned, and you can do this. We've got a set curriculum for you. Or if you're a physician in practice and you'd like to invite your patients to come in and just use the waiting room as a teaching area after hours, your patients are going to love you for it. And we have a curriculum you can use and instructors who will be thrilled to hook up with you. So there's no reason for us to just wring our hands and say, you know, people are on rotten diets, what are we going to do? It is the easiest thing in the world to pump people up, to take charge of their health. This is not rocket science. Anybody can do it. So there we are.
One of the obstacles that people face is the belief that's fairly widespread in our culture. You need to consume dairy products to have healthy bones. And if you don't consume dairy products, you won't have healthy bones.
Right.
But there was just another study recently that demonstrated that milk actually can have a negative effect on bone health. In this one, researchers in Sweden published their findings in the British Medical Journal, showing that women who drink milk have a higher incidence of bone fractures and an increased risk of mortality from heart disease and cancer. They found specifically that women who consume three or more glasses of milk per day have a 60% increased risk of developing a hip fracture. Well, here's my question to you, Neil. We do know that for strong bones, it is important to have enough calcium and enough vitamin D. But why is it then that so many studies are suggesting that despite the claims of the dairy industry advertising milk, it actually does a body bad?
You know, it certainly is a puzzle. And a number of years ago, we started jumping in on some of these dairy claims. And the first one that we really jumped in a big way was related to dairy products, suggested that dairy products could help you lose weight. You remember this one?
I do.
If you have a low-calorie diet that includes dairy products, you lose more weight than a low-calorie diet alone.
Yes, they were claiming that a lot.
Right. And well, we challenged that through the Federal Trade Commission, and it took them about 2 years to reach a decision, but they finally did, and the Federal Trade Commission ruled in our favor, saying you've got to scrap those dairy ads, which was great. But when we looked at the science on it, it was so flimsy that caused us to look back at these other claims that people have just accepted, including the one you mentioned, which is milk builds strong bones. We all grew up with that. It's hard to imagine that isn't the case. You know, if a kid has growing bones, they need calcium from milk, and then perhaps just as enthusiastically promoted is the idea that older folks, particularly older women who are at risk for hip fractures, they need milk too, to protect them. Well, when you look at the science of it, just as you said, John, it's not that way. Researchers at Penn State started looking at kids. The kids who drank the least milk or none at all had no problems with bone integrity and no worse bone integrity than the kids drinking the most milk. And the same is true at the other end of the life spectrum, that older women in particular who drink the most milk, either they get no protection, added protection, or they're even worse off. And exactly why they would be worse off, we don't know. But the bottom line is that milk is, at best, unnecessary and a very hard recommendation to carry forward.
It is hard for us to get past sometimes the cultural conditioning and awaken to what science is telling us. I heard Walter Willett, who's the chairman of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health, say that there are many studies that have shown a relationship between high milk intake and the risk of fatal metastatic prostate cancer. That fact alone, I think, can turn men away from dairy products if they realize that by consuming them, they are actually increasing their risk of prostate cancer.
Oh, yeah. This has been going on for quite a number of years. The first one that caught our attention was the Physicians Health Study under Dr. Willett at Harvard. 21,000 physicians studied for a number of years, and just as you said, those who drank the most milk had the higher risk of prostate cancer. And it was about 30-plus percent higher than the non-milk drinking people. So predicated on that, they did another study, larger study. This is called the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. And it was more people tracked for a long period of time. Exactly the same result, though. In this case, the people who had more dairy products had about a 60% increased risk of developing prostate cancer. And the reasons for this are not entirely clear, but one of the ones that jumps out at us especially is that milk, I guess nature's idea for milk, you might put it that, if you put it that way, is to provide a calf something that will really foster very rapid growth. So the calf is nursing, the calf is drinking the milk, and the calf is getting protein and fat, a lot of sugar, because lactose sugar is very concentrated in milk, obviously, plus hormones, and this cocktail within the calf's body causes the production of something called IGF-1, which I know you've written about. An insulin-like growth factor is a potent stimulus for cancer cell growth. Now, that's not a problem for the calf, because the calf is only going to nurse for a couple months, and then that's it. And that was sort of nature's idea that we would be weaned. Human beings drink mother's milk, but we're all weaned. But if you're going to continue to drink this cocktail of hormones and protein and fat and sugar all your life, your IGF-1 level will rise. And this has been shown in research studies. You can bring in people, not children, I'm talking about older folks who are drinking milk, and you can show that their IGF-1 levels in their blood go right up. And you do not want that. You want growth when you're a nursing infant, but when you're an adult, growth can mean the growth of cancer cells, dangerous stuff. So milk is for babies. It should be milk from their mother, and that's really it.
Well, we know there's a direct correlation between IGF-1 levels and cancer rates.
Right, and not only for men, by the way. People have been looking at the links between IGF-1 and breast cancer as well. So the whole idea of getting the body in overdrive with overnutrition, in other words, not the nutrition your body needs, but excess. So what is milk? It's more protein than you need, more sugar than you need, more fat than you need, more hormones than anyone would ever want. And you're driving your body, and that kind of overdrive, in my view, is likely to increase the risk of a number of forms of cancer, because what is cancer? Cancer is cells that are multiplying out of control and not being contained by the body.
Well, a baby calf is a ruminant animal. It has, as we say, four stomachs. It will gain maybe 250 pounds in its first year. And so I've sometimes said to people, well, if you have four stomachs and you want to gain 250 pounds in a first year, drink a lot of milk.
Yeah, that's true. I have to say, what is worrying me, particularly nowadays, is looking at cultures overseas that are making diet changes right now. I'm thinking particularly of China, where China historically has been an area where the diet was based on rice and other grains and vegetables and so forth, but because of newfound affluence, we are seeing much more meat consumption, much more milk consumption, and we're seeing exactly what one would fear, which is more obesity, more diabetes, more heart disease, and I think in coming generations we're going to see cancers that really were quite rare in the past but are rearing their ugly head. It's very unfortunate to see that in China right now, but that's exactly what's going on right now.
We are exporting the Western diet to the detriment of those who take it on. Perhaps the most important guideline in preventing cancer is to eat lots of fruits and vegetables. Can you tell us about the components in foods like cabbage and mushrooms and green tea and turmeric and tomatoes and other plant foods that have unique and potent cancer-preventing qualities?
Well, there's one thing that I think that anybody can grasp, and that's that when you walk into the produce counter of your grocery store and you look at the beautiful orange carrots, the bright red tomatoes, the dark purple grapes and blueberries, you think, aren't they pretty? And they're very attractive, but they're not just pretty. The human retina is able to detect antioxidants and to interpret them as positive and attractive. So when you're looking at the bright orange carrot, what you're actually seeing is beta carotene. Now, your dog can walk in with you to the grocery store, or your cat. They don't have the same color vision that you do. It's more rudimentary because they're naturally carnivores. So a cat is looking for motion. They're looking for a little mouse. And a dog has a very good sense of smell, tremendous hearing. They can hear at frequencies we can't hear because they are attuned to prey. We have cute little ears and cute little noses that are really not very good for sniffing out prey, which is good because, you know, you don't have to sneak up on a strawberry. So they're just there for us to pick. But we have very, very good color vision. So you look at the beta carotene in a carrot, it's bright orange, it screams out at you. That red tomato, the red color comes from lycopene, which is an even more powerful antioxidant than the beta carotene. In the blueberries, that deep color comes from what are called anthocyanins. And they are powerful antioxidants in blueberries, also in grapes, and in a number of other plants. Now, we take those colors today, and we put them in an M&M's bag, and they mean nothing to us anymore. But nature was basically trying to just beat us over the head with the idea that these are beautiful, attractive colors that we should bring into our lives and take advantage of them. What do they do in your body? Antioxidants knock out free radicals. Free radicals are these damaging sparks that will attack your DNA and can cause the DNA in a cell to change so that that cell becomes a cancer cell. You want to protect yourself with this fire extinguisher, which comes from antioxidants. So the carrot and the tomato and all these other brightly colored vegetables and fruits are there to protect you, and that should be remembered.
Well, they also contain fiber, and animal products do not. And we know that fiber helps people lose weight and that it relieves constipation and other digestive problems. Neil, does it also help prevent cancer?
Yeah, I think it does. People have debated this back and forth, and I think the jury has really come back in the room and said yes. And the simple-minded way of thinking about this really bears out pretty well, which is that fiber is sort of like a broom that as it goes down your digestive tract, fiber, which is plant roughage, it's not absorbed, it's not digested in the first part of the digestive process, so it just kind of moves things along. And so if carcinogens were in foods that you ingested, or if they are forming in your body, they get swept out with the waste. And by the way, let me make a pitch for this. Foods have two kinds of fiber, as you know. The insoluble fiber, that's the fiber that does not dissolve in water. And you see it in wheat or in rice, for example. That's a really good broom for your digestive tract. And then soluble fiber, which is in oats. So you know how your oatmeal gets gooey in the morning? That's because the fiber dissolves in the water. Also, there's soluble fiber in beans. That fiber, it acts like a little bit of a broom, and it does move digestive contents along, but it also lowers cholesterol. And every bite of these foods that have soluble fiber in them will bring your cholesterol down a little bit. So why do people on plant-based diets have low cholesterol? It's because they're not eating cholesterol, they're not eating the animal fat that makes it, but fiber also helps carry it away. So that's a really handy thing. And I often feel compelled to cheerlead for these simple, cheap foods that are loaded with fiber. Beans have, they have protein, they've got iron, they've got a surprising amount of calcium, they've got soluble fiber and insoluble fiber, they even have a trace of omega-3. Beans don't have a good lobby group, but they're very helpful for you. They've got all of this, these wonderful nutrients that helps keep us healthy.
Yeah, they're a central part of my diet, legumes of all types. Part of it is the fiber that they provide, the protein. There's many, many nutrients, as you mentioned, that they give us. In the world of fiber, there are many packaged food companies now trying to boost the sales of their products by adding extra fiber to things like gummy candy or yogurt. When you see that happening, Neil, what goes through your mind?
I have to tell you, John, it is the biggest tragedy. You can go into any drugstore and you'll see shelf after shelf of products that are fiber supplements. You think, what are you doing? That's simply a sign that you didn't eat the natural forms of fiber that nature had in mind for you. So beans have fiber. They are the fiber champions. But vegetables are right behind them. Fruits are there, too. And whole grains have a lot of fiber, too. So anybody who's following a plant-based diet is going to get loads of fiber. However, a slice of cheese is not from a plant, so it does not have any fiber at all. And that's true for fish, that's true for chicken, it's true for meat, it's true for eggs. These are not plants, they have no fiber. So the more the animal products come into your diet, the more the fiber is not there, it's displaced. And in an extreme, you're on something like an Atkins type of diet, where it's very meaty, not much in the way of plant foods, and these people sometimes have constipation of heroic proportions. So if people are taking fiber supplements, what they really need to do is bring the vegetables and beans and fruits back into their diet.
Well, and you're helping them to do that in so many ways. We know that when people eat fast food, they eat more calories, and often it's the worst kind of food for their health. And we also know how little nutritional education there is in medical schools still, though that's improving. Thanks in part to your organization, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And I know that your group recently examined more than 200 public hospitals, many of which receive government funding, and found that many have contracts with fast food chains. McDonald's alone has restaurants in many public hospitals, as does Chick-fil-A and Wendy's and others. What is going on when these fast food companies are actually operating in public hospitals?
You know, a hospital is supposed to be a place where you go to get well, but it today can be a place you go to get sick. Greenville Memorial Hospital in Greenville, South Carolina, has three fast food outlets in it, so you can go there and stop in and have Chick-fil-A while you're on your way to have your coronary bypass. We found these Grady Hospital, which is a big hospital with really hardworking employees in Atlanta, Georgia. But it has a McDonald's there, and we, through the Freedom of Information Act, we looked at the contract, and what we showed was that the more money the McDonald's makes, I'm talking about a McDonald's at the hospital, the more money the McDonald's makes, the more money the hospital makes. Their fates are tied together. And we've seen this in a number of places, where not only are they renting out space, but they're profiting from it, and in some cases they are even obliged to promote it. So it's got to stop. I remember, it's really been a generation ago now, my hospital, George Washington University Hospital. We were sitting in a room deciding about banning smoking from the hospital. And it sounds ridiculous to say that, wait a minute, you would sell cigarettes in the gift shop? You would allow patients to smoke in their rooms? Doctors would smoke in the doctor's lounge? Yes, that's exactly what happened. And we made the decision that we had to do something about it. And we did. And we got rid of smoking. And as soon as we did, everyone realized it was the right thing to do. Well, today, we are having exactly the same problem with food, that everybody knows there's a problem. Everyone knows that these foods are not good for you, and yet hospitals think, well, at least people will eat something. I need to make money, da-da-da. Those are not excuses. It's got to go, and a hospital should not only take care of you when you're desperately ill and get you back on your feet, but send you on the road to health by teaching you healthful eating habits. While you're in the hospital, let's say you're there for a hip fracture. The hip fracture is not going to kill you in most cases. But what will kill you is your smoking habit. And while you're in the hospital for 3 or 4 days, they will not let you smoke, and that is a good nodal point allowing you to get on a healthier path. While you're in the hospital should feed you low-fat vegan food every day and say to you explicitly, this is a chance to taste these foods, to take home some recipes, to have your spouse understand it too, and if you want to continue when you get back home, your health is going to rebound, and your likelihood of having to be back in the hospital for something else, a heart disease or diabetes or whatever, will be dramatically reduced. That's the hospital of tomorrow. But if we banned smoking a generation ago, we can tackle food. There's no reason we can't. It's just a question of us getting the will together to do it.
When I think of hospitals selling fast food, there's the damage that the food that they're providing does to the bodies of the people who are there presumably for healing. But there's another factor, too. Because people are vulnerable when they're in a hospital and they give up their power to the hospital rules, it's a very, very formidable institution and people are often feeling very vulnerable when they're there. And so there's a sense that the hospital is giving the stamp of its authority to this food. So there's not only the fact that the people are eating this food while they're there, but when they go home, it's as though the hospital has said, this is the healing food for you. Or they somehow legitimized some of the worst food. And you used the phrase, obligated to promote it. That the hospitals are, in some cases, by their contracts with these fast food operations, obligated to promote this food as well as provide it?
Yes, that's exactly right. And what you just mentioned, which is the idea that being associated with the hospital is going to make the fast food look good, that idea is not lost on the fast food chains. And there's a hospital in Augusta, Georgia. It's called Georgia Regents Medical Center. It's a children's hospital. Not only is there a McDonald's there, but you can have McDonald's delivered to you in the hospital. So your child is sick, and you can have a quote-unquote happy meal delivered to the bedside there. And so McDonald's will say, well, isn't this cheerful? It's happy. Hospitals are scary places. We're familiar. We're going to make everybody feel good. And it's really unfortunate that fat and cholesterol now have that valence because they really should not. They're obviously part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Yes, they are. And I saw a documentary that your organization, PCRM, recently released called The Power to Heal Diabetes, Food for Life in Indian Country. Now, we know that the Native American population in this country has very, very high rates of diabetes. And your film features Native Americans who have managed and even reversed diabetes when they've adopted a plant-strong diet. This is a disease that's rampant among Native Americans, and its incidence is painfully climbing in just about every population subgroup in the country. Even children now have a 30% chance of developing it. What have you learned through working with Native Americans about diabetes and about healthy traditions?
Yeah, a number of years ago, I was asked to be on a radio show that was broadcast to a number of Native American tribes. And in the course of the broadcast, they were asking me about diabetes for the reason that you mentioned, because it's such a problem among Native Americans. And I mentioned our research where we took away the meat and the dairy products and eggs, and our diet was a vegan diet, grains and beans, vegetables, and fruits. And a woman called into the program, and she said that she lived in New Mexico, and she had just toured one of the pueblos, and she saw that they were talking about growing the three sisters, which she said were corn and beans and squash, and that these were grown together. And they described this agricultural system that was centuries old for growing these plants. And she said that system sounded very much like our approach, and that kept her ancestors healthy. It wasn't a meaty diet, it was a plant-strong diet. So I very soon got on a plane, and I flew out to New Mexico and to travel to Arizona, and I met with the special diabetes program at the Navajo Nation in Window Rock, Arizona. And I asked them lots and lots of questions about their traditional diet, and they explained them to me. And then in turn, I showed what we had found with our research studies on vegan diets, and we decided to work together. And for the past several years, we have been sharing what we both know with each other, and it has been the most gratifying thing that you can imagine. And a number of people have taken advantage of this, and they're getting healthier day by day. And we've got a long way to go, but it has been wonderful to see. And the reception that our research has gotten has been really wonderful. So that's why we made the DVD. And by the way, the title, I'm talking about being in Indian country, that was the title that our friends at the reservation had wanted to call it. I thought we should call it Native American country. They said, no, we're going to call it this.
They wanted Indian country.
That's what they did.
Yeah, okay.
And whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. But our Native American friends chose that title. So anyhow, we are distributing it like crazy. You'll see it on our website. If you go to pcrm.org, you can watch the video.
The Power to Heal Diabetes, Food for Life in Indian Country.
That's it.
We're seeing more and more the power of excellent nutrition to lessen our risk of many diseases, which always leads me to wonder whether it can also improve mental and emotional health. There was a recent study published actually in the March-April issue this year of the American Journal of Health Promotion that demonstrates that a plant-based nutrition program improves depression, anxiety, fatigue, productivity, and other markers of mental and emotional well-being. Are you familiar with that study?
Yeah. When we were in our GEICO trial, the 10-city one that I mentioned earlier, we were looking at mainly at body weight and at blood sugar control and cholesterol control and that kind of thing. However, in the course of this, we also looked at mood and signs of depression, signs of anxiety, and also productivity. And what we found was that in the people who were following the plant-based diet, those things got better. And we didn't exactly expect, or let me put it this way, we couldn't exactly account for it. All we knew was that in some prior trials, we had seen people who, when they make these changes, they do feel better. You know, their depression seems to lift a little bit. So that was really an outgrowth of what we had done there. What I would like to see at this point, though, is a bigger trial and studies in people who really are suffering with depression, because, frankly, the drugs aren't so hot.
Yeah.
And they have side effects. And there has been some studies also on exercise. Now, when you're depressed, the last thing you feel like doing is lacing up your sneakers. But with a little bit of help and support, you can help people to do vigorous, brisk walking, get the junk out of their diets, eat in a more healthful way, and I would not be surprised to see that kind of regimen helping mood. And then as weight comes down and other things improve, the physical changes boost mood even further.
Neil, it's been my pleasure to know you and your work for nearly 30 years now. Our mutual friend Dean Ornish calls you one of the leading pioneers in educating the public about the healing power of diet and nutrition. In a day when very few doctors know very much about the healing power of nutrition, you stand out. You show us all what we can do to take charge of our health and in the process contribute to a healthier world for everyone. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. It's been a privilege to speak with you today. And on behalf of myself and Ocean and everyone involved in the Food Revolution Network, I want to thank you for being with us today and for your ongoing and courageous and excellent work on behalf of a healthier food future for us all.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you, Ocean. And as I said at the beginning, I really consider this very much a team effort. You have inspired me ever since the beginning, and it's been terrific working with you. And I'm hoping that all the listeners will also not forget to let their members of Congress know what they want done. And so part of our collective team effort is to let people know what they can do to change the world. So that's why we're sending out action alerts and letting people know about all the things that they can get involved in. So thank you for including me, John. You're making the world a better place.
Well, you certainly are too, Neil. We're doing it together, and it is a pleasure and an honor to work with you. We've been talking here with Dr. Neil Barnard, founder and president of Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, bestselling author of 15 books, including Power Foods for the Brain. Neil, your message is vitally important to the health of tens of millions, and you deliver it with clarity and with potency. You're helping to shift the course of medicine, and you are empowering individuals and governments all over the planet. We want to thank you for your decades of impeccable research, for sharing your critical insights, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you, Ocean.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources from our speakers and partners. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.